Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Friday. Yes, it's Friday, February 8th, 2013. And this is The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson. I have a question for you. Do you know where your politicians are? Everything is political in your life, from the moment you're born to the moment you die. And when a politician tells you that's not true, look in your pocket. You'll find their hand in it. Everything is political. And on this show, we're going to be discussing those who are working for you and those who are working against you. Just because they are a Democrat or just because they're a Republican and you voted that way your entire life, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody is not what they seem to be. However, there are a few out there who are working for your benefit, and we're going to bring them to you. We're going to let you hear them. We're going to let you ask them questions. And we're also going to be discussing a lot of other things. The education system, the military, science, sports, healthcare. Do you have it? Do you need it? Are you 26 years old and still on your family's healthcare plan? I hope. Or, as the Regressive Party says, Obamacare. We will bring what you need to know because that is the last word. In everything, from the cities, counties, the state, the entire nation, and the world. So sit down and get a pencil, a piece of paper, and take this hour as a classroom experience. And we will make sure that you have the last word. My name is Michael Lawson. Okay, we are here. There's not going to be any calls today because we are doing a pre-tape show because I will be away in Charleston, South Carolina. Matter of fact, I'm leaving town in Charlotte tomorrow. And it was the death of my wife's family, so we have to go down there for a funeral. And her mother is still there, and her family, she's from Charleston. So we will be gallivanting, having some shrimp, and some other things that I think are good to eat down there in the that city. Matter of fact, it's a small, small city. a lot of people might not know, is called Adams Run. It's right off of, well, it's near Old Military Highway, Highway 17. But we are going to have a great time after the funeral, as I always do when I go down there. I love our family, and I love the food even better. So, but in the meantime, we got a good show today. We are going to have the Reverend Kojo Mantumbu. I hope I got that right, Kojo. Who's the president of the NAACP. We've been doing a three-parter because the HKRJ, which starts this Saturday, February the 9th, in Raleigh, they're expecting a mass of people, in excess of 20,000 people. This is their seventh anniversary. And they're going up there to have a rally right outside, the assembly, to let these regressive party members up there who have taken over our government in this state, to let them know that we're watching them and we're not going to let them get away with what they think they're going to get away with. Joining Reverend Kojo is going to be Luis Rodriguez, community organizer for Action North Carolina, and they have been part of this whole HKRJ, which is they named the J stands for Jones Street, which is where they march up. They're going to start from Shaw University, and they're going to march all the way to the State Assembly, which is about a mile and a half or so, 2 miles. We're also going to have Grace Leem, who is the Cabarrus County Chair for the Democratic Party for in the 8th District, and her and that fiasco that's been going on up there in the Democratic Party. We finally got the tormentor for the Democratic Party out of office. He's no longer the chair of the party. And they tried to bring Grace up on charges because she wanted to back our president and our vice president and didn't want to back Larry Kissel from the 8th District, who completely disowned our president. We'll talk about that later. But so there's quite a few things we're going to be talking about. And I hope that everybody is sitting back and just with my notes here and just ready to listen. And as a matter of fact, I think it's going to be a smoking show. And let's see, right now, who we have here? We have a gentleman from the Washington-based Advancement Project, Reverend Edward Hales. We've had on our show before, and I am delighted to have him back. Good morning, Reverend. How are you?
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
And I hope it's – how's the weather in Washington?
Well, it's chilly, but a little bit of the sun, and, you know, we've had chillier days, so
– I'm sure you have.
Okay.
And snowier days, too, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And let me kill this phone here. I don't know why I got this phone going. Anyway, so, Reverend, I since we last talked, matter of fact, it was last year when all that fiasco was going on down there in Florida.
Right.
And what is the Advancement Project? What have they done since? I know you've been involved up to your eyeballs with the shenanigans of Florida, Rick Scott and whatnot. What has happened in the meantime since then, since we last spoke?
Well, I'll tell you, we were impressed and gratified that voters overcame so many different schemes that were put in place to make it more difficult for them to participate in last year's presidential election. That
mm-hmm.
voters turned out despite the cutbacks in early voting opportunities, the third-party voter registration requirements, the uncertainty and the the problems with these restrictive photo ID requirements. There were just so many schemes put in place to make it harder for people who wanted to vote and were eligible to vote to participate in our democracy. So we fought back in courts and with messages that made it clear that that people who were entitled to vote had an opportunity and indeed an obligation to lift up their voices in the election and not to be turned back because people did not want them to vote. And so we were able to make a lot of inroads and get voters prepared to fight back against intimidation and questions that were raised about their eligibility, and they turned out and reelected the president of the United States. And right after the election, we began to see already new moves afoot by the party in opposition to the president, seeking to find ways to make it easier for their Republican nominees to win future elections. They decided in state legislatures where the majority members of the legislatures were in the Republican Party to see if they could come up with new rules on the Electoral College, the way the votes are awarded to the electors who vote for who will make it, who will become the president. And
well, you know, I don't want to cut you off, but, you know, didn't they learn their lesson during this last election that they tried to kill the vote? And didn't that make the dude? I think the way it was, 5 million votes, I think that if they did not put these morons that they had up for election and they didn't try to suppress the vote like they did, they could have won this election. But I think they angered the people so much that people came out who never would have come out, and people stood in line in Florida, for 8 hours, 10 hours.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you are so right that people they just saw right through these efforts to game the system and give partisan advantage to the party. So they said, no, we're not going to take it. We're going to show up. And this is we support the president, but we also are looking out for our own interest. And if they're not doing it just to this president, they are doing it to us. They're trying to take away our votes, and we're not going to take it.
And the thing that you know their major scheme was, okay, yeah, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and we're not going to take Obamacare. We don't want no part of it. And now they're all coming around. Rick Scott, yesterday, Ohio governor, he's coming around. Jan Brewer. What's the story here? So now they all want, they see money. That's the problem. They see money.
There you go. That's right.
And now, as far as where is the, at this point in time, the Advancement Project, what are, and for the people who don't know what the Advancement Project does, can you give us a short rundown of how you are involved and have been helping this country, and along with a lot of other organizations, but you guys have been really out front very much. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, thank you, Brother Lawson. We have been in existence since 1998. We are a national civil rights and racial justice action tank. We work on the ground in support of local organizing efforts informed by careful legal reasoning and strategic communications. We have national and local partners around the country that identify problems that are happening at the state and local level. And we provide technical resources with our experienced lawyers and strategic communications experts, mapping experts to both put a spotlight on problems, but also provide recommended solutions based on work we've done around the country.
Mm-hmm. And the main thing that's that you guys are involved with right now is this the electoral process as far as electing the president in each state.
Yeah,
tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we have looked at needed reforms to the Electoral College for some time. I mean, no one thinks that the current system is perfect. Certainly, in the after the 2000 presidential election, the Bush v. Gore decision, the Supreme Court basically declared that the individual citizen has no federal constitutional right to vote for electors for the president of the United States unless and until the state legislature chooses a statewide election as a means to implement its powers to appoint members of the Electoral College. So then that flagged for us that we do not have an affirmative, explicit constitutional right to vote. And so for some time now, we have been pushing for a national consensus in support of amending the United States Constitution so we have in very explicit affirmative language as exists in other nations, other democracies, including South Africa, explicit language that says all Americans over the age of 18 have a constitutional right to vote. We have over 13,000, I should say, jurisdictions that implement voting systems and interpret rules differently. So that means whenever we go someplace, we have to study their particular voting system to make sure that the citizens have the right to vote. Now, what is I say that because we know that there are some issues with our electoral college right now. There are more white citizens that live in the so-called battleground states than voters of color. But voters of color have increased their share of the electoral vote in recent elections, especially this last election. And so now you have people saying, well, one reason why the president was elected was because he was able to get states that have larger numbers of voters of color supporting him. But if we broke it down by congressional district as opposed to the national vote of the entire state, then by congressional district we have more Republican Republican-led congressional districts within states. So why don't we come up with a system that awards votes to the Electoral College based on these congressional districts and not statewide? And they know by doing that, they would get a larger share of the Electoral College votes. And then since it's Electoral College, by way of the Constitution, that determines who is elected president, then they think that they can win. In fact, even though the president clearly won the national popular vote in this last election, if you broke it down by congressional district, Mitt Romney would be president today.
Well, that's only because they gerrymandered all the districts.
That's exactly right. They stack, they pack, and they crack the districts of voters of color. And
right,
they have more congressional representation, even though more Democratic votes have gone for members of Congress, there's a majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives.
Yeah,
it's because of the way they do the redistricting.
A million and a half more people voted for Democratic representatives than Republican representatives. So, but now a lot of people don't understand this proportionment and this. How can we make a connection between House proportion now to back to the three-fifths compromise? I mean,
yeah.
Because I mean, that's where it came from, correct?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's how you attempt to win elections, by gaining a partisan advantage by breaking it down in a proportionate way. And it does go all the way back to the three-fifths of a person compromised in the Constitution from the very beginning. And so when we see these proposals, it's already toxic. It's already radioactive for us. As soon as we see these proposals, we think back on that original constitutional compromise, and we say, look, we cannot let this go unexamined, unreported. We've got to get the word out that there's something wrong with this, that people are trying to game the system for a partisan advantage. And so that's what we've been able to do. And so far, once the alarm went up that there's something wrong with this, many of the Republican legislatures have started to back away from them. But in Pennsylvania, they're still considering it. And one reason we think they started backing away from it, because in 2014, you'll have some more statewide elections and even some gubernatorial elections this year. And they don't want to be seen as trying to game the system, because they know what happened in 2012 when voters saw that the that these schemes were in place and they fought back. So they said, uh-oh.
Yeah, but you know, I think you're correct. When you're dealing with people that are, when you deal with people that are really for the people, this regressive party, as I call them, this, and they're a small, minute portion of the Republican Party. They have scared real Republicans so bad that they could be challenged in a primary. That that's the reason why they're in bed with the tiger right now. And now the tiger's running out of food and is looking at them licking their chops. So the thing is that they all these, I think it was about six or seven states, I think it was Florida, Michigan, and a bunch of
Ohio
and Pennsylvania. But they've all come around now and said, oh, you know what? We don't want to do this. But you see, the thing is that they know, just like the governor of Pennsylvania, he will not get elected again because he has torn his pants already.
Yeah.
And Bob McDonald in Florida, he's not going to get elected again because he tore his pants. The problem is, though, with the redistricting, I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was the first vice chair for the 8th Congressional District until the people did not vote in 2010 and in 2011 and 12 when they redistricted everything. I was moved out of the 8th District, so I am no longer the first vice chair of the 8th District.
Right.
Now, the 8th District was Mecklenburg County, which is probably, it's one of the largest, it is the largest district next to Wake County in the state. And Mecklenburg County was the one that got Larry Kissel elected. He would not have gotten elected without our district.
Right.
The 8th District. So when they redistricted everything, they took, we had about 31 precincts. There are now two precincts in the 8th district. And the other precincts all were thrown into the 12th precinct, which is 12th district, which is Mel Watts district, which is majority African American.
African American already.
So,
yeah.
Absolutely. So this is an example of packing.
That's
and
right.
There are suits in right now. That I know the NAACP has a suit in against this. And the last time they tried this, it was overturned and everything was put back. So there is a good possibility that can happen again.
True. True. And that also leads to this whole point of voting rights and the in Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act being under review by the Supreme Court. Arguments will be at the end of this month on the Shelby County decision, and we're looking very closely and filed with other groups an amicus brief saying that we need to protect Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires preclearance of some of these redistricting moves if it's going to have a negative impact on voters of color.
Well, has an Amiga brief been put together in Texas anywhere? I'm sure it has.
Yes, yes.
Okay, because they know they can't stop that train. That train is coming down the tracks, and it is going to be minority in at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they will. They know they will not get elected again.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't make changes now where they can stop this train or get on the train,
right?
The game is lost. Texas will be blue by 2020.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
So now, how does the Advancement Project pick their fights?
Well, we like to because we have developed strong working relationships with groups on the ground who take the lead on actions that will make it better for their people to participate. We wait for requests to provide the resources we have, but we always look to see if there is a historically disenfranchised community, that there's a concentration of voters of color that are being locked out by some move, and then we look to see if there are activities that are ongoing that need some need to be challenged or need to be addressed right away.
So you're located all across the country then, right?
Well,
I know you're California and other places.
That's right. That's right. And now our national office, and that's where I work, is in Washington, D.C.
Right.
But we
mm-hmm.
do have attorneys and other experts working on the ground in different states.
Now,
and we have a California office as well.
Did you have – I know you had people out in this last election monitoring the vote.
That's right. In Florida and Wisconsin and North Carolina, Texas, Nevada, Ohio. So we were in several states across the country on election day and before election day, just trying to make sure that voters were protected.
Right. Did you find any Democrats voting 2 and 3 times?
Didn't find that.
You didn't find that. So the whole idea that people who aren't Democrats or who are Democrats voting half a dozen times, or people who aren't even registered voting 2 and 3 times, that you did not find. That does not occur then, or did occur.
We did not see or receive any reports like that. No.
So there hasn't been any reports by the Republican Party that took place?
None that we have seen, no.
So that means that everybody voted for the socialist who was president. that's what I'm hearing. That means
no.
So everybody wanted the socialist by like over 5.5 million votes. So
right.
Is there something wrong with this picture? I mean, I just can't comprehend this.
Yeah.
It just gets out of hand. So now,
tell you on that very, very point, it almost became amusing to see the lengths that people would go to that seemed so obvious to an outsider but seemed mm-hmm. so real to them. There was a Republican legislator in New Hampshire that said that he saw all of these black people standing in line to vote. He said he had never seen all these black people. But and it was just a reminder of Ralph Ellison's invisible man concept. Like, a lot, there are certain white people that will see black people every day but not really see them. But all of a sudden it became important to him that people were actually voting against his interest, and then they became visible all of a sudden. It was just amazing, like magic. They just showed up.
You know, it is so unbelievable.
Yes.
And nobody knew them, he said.
Oh, right.
And nobody knew them. Where did they come from? I mean, it's like they just came out of the earth.
Out of the vapors, yeah, vapors.
Now, the thing is that the thing that I don't understand is how do you have enough nerve? Do they ever listen to what they say?
I know.
Ever listen to what they say? It sounds so incredible. Speaking about that, the incredible Wayne LaPierre was on with on Fox, and Chris Wallace, who I guess he wasn't expecting, asked him the question about the president's children and why they ran the ad. Talking, he said, "Well, we didn't. We really weren't targeting them." He said, "But you mentioned them." He says, "Yes, well, you know, but the a lot of people have bodyguards." He said, "Yeah, just like you." He said, "Well, I have said, but you got them in the studio here." and he stuttered. He didn't know what to say. How do you say things when they're so obvious?
So obvious,
outrageous. I mean,
right.
It makes no comment whatsoever.
I tell you, you
can also say that about Alan West. I mean,
that's
he had 71 communists in the Democratic Party in the House. I mean, so they only listen to one channel, and that one channel gives them a direction to go with blinders on. So this is what those people expect to hear, and they don't care what anybody else hears outside of it. Outside Fox News, outside Fox World, these Republican candidates feel that they can say anything at any time and without any reaction, because their segment of their audience is only geared to listening to one theme and one sound.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you for, I know you are very busy, and I want to thank you for coming on our show again. And I would like to ask you to come back after the decision has been made.
Okay.
I know one of the, what is the decision will be made in the, is the Supreme Court hearing the decision?
The arguments are in at the end of this month. And I think the 26th, and so probably in May, we should expect a decision.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
And if anything else is breaking before then, I definitely will call you, ask you to come back and explain to everybody what is going on.
Okay, well, thank you for this opportunity, and I wish you the best.
I thank you very much, as usual.
All right.
Thank you.
Take
good
care. Bye now.
And that was Reverend Eddie Hales from the Advancement Project, who gave us a rundown on what the heck is going on. Had a little interference on the line there. I hope that it didn't come through. I could hear it through my headsets. But we will, as always, rely on Mr. Hales to give us the straight scoop. Well, I want to tell you, there are a couple things going on that are really unbelievable. You know, have you heard about these secret memos that about the targeted killings that we are doing? I'm on both sides of the fence here. I'm on both sides of the fence. Excuse me. We are, since President Obama's been in office, he has almost doubled or tripled the use of drones to win the war on terrorism. There are a lot of people that are very, very upset with him, friends of mine, because he's using it, using these drones. Now, this is not, even though they say it, this is not a world war. We are not fighting a world war, even though terrorists are all over the world. This is not a world war. World war, the termination which is commonly used, is where everybody was on somebody's side and they were fighting one another. This is not the case here. This is a guerrilla war, a guerrilla world war. Guerrillas do not fight fair. Now, that's why they call them a guerrillas. Guerrillas do not fight fair. Yes, we have the probably the biggest, the strongest military in the world. But unless you have been in the Army or the Marines or the Navy or the Air Force or the Coast Guard or the Reserve or the Guard and been shot at under fire, I just don't believe that you can really be that hostile to what the president is doing. If I was over there fighting in one of those military outfits, I would expect the president of the United States to win at all costs, to protect my butt, whether I was on the ground or flying a plane or on a ship. You can't win with your hands tied. The object of war is to win. The object of fighting is to win. We do not go into a fight to tie. We do not go into a fight to lose. We do not go into a fight to lose an arm, a leg, an eye, a hand, a foot. We go in to win at all costs, or you don't fight. You don't fight. And if you don't fight, the bully will always win. The Christmas story. Everybody knows the Christmas story. Every time he used to go to school, the bully used to jump on him and beat him up. Until one day, the bully picked the wrong day. He was just upset, and I'm trying to remember why he was upset. It was maybe he broke his glasses. I think that's what it was. I can't remember. But anyway, the bully jumped on him, and he beat the bully to smithereens. And the rest of the time when the bully saw him, he ran. Now, if we were just fighting fisticuffs, it's a different story. But they're not playing to lose. They're not playing to die, even though they say they are. They're playing to win because they think they will outlast us. And that's a different ideology. So if we use drones to get the terrorists, then we use drones to get the terrorists. And of course, along with the use of drones, you have collateral damage. Well, it was 3,000 collateral damages, 3,000 worth of collateral damage in the World Trade Centers when they crashed to the ground. So I would like if there was some way that we could change that scenario. We're no longer destroying cities like they did in Dresden or Tokyo or Nagasaki or Hiroshima. Yes, they're killing 100 people just to get at maybe 5 people. Or one person. So, but as John Kerry said, how do you, when he made his speech to Congress on Vietnam, he says, how do you, stopping the war, bringing the soldiers home, how do you tell the person that he has to be the last person to come home? How do you tell our soldiers that are over there that are fighting these terrorists that we're not going to give them the help that they need to prevent terrorists from attacking them? And this thing about the American, we killed an American, we sanctioned a kill on an American. I get it. I understand. But when someone goes to the other side, they're on the other side. They're not with us anymore. And so why should we determine, why should we even offer them a chance to surrender when they went on the other side? And they're not going to surrender. I mean, you know, this is that was one of the there's a memo. Let me read this. This is just came out, as a matter of fact, a few minutes ago. The secret memos exposed Obama's double standard on target killings. Okay. People want to know where the outrage is between the Bush era torture policies and President Obama's justification for killing American citizens with no due process, no transparency, and no accountability. Michael Isikoff was talking about the Obama's Orwellian justification for assassinating American citizens, believed to be the senior, you know, just sort of a senior operational leaders for Al-Qaeda. Killing suspected terrorists who happen to be Americans is not an assassination, according to the president's Justice Department. We have been going out and killing American citizens for a long time. When the FBI says they put out a list, wanted dead or alive, what the heck do you think that means? It means wanted, dead, or alive. Whichever way you can, dead or alive. Now, if we're going to go after a targeted American citizen who is now working with Al-Qaeda, are we supposed to send in 1,000 troops, SEAL Team 6, into another country just to get this person when he has a whole army with him? That didn't happen with, that's not what happened with Bin Laden. Bin Laden didn't have, he was hiding out because he was a wanted terrorist. But he was hiding out in a place where people didn't say anything. He didn't have an army around him. That's why we could send in SEAL Team 6. And it wasn't in the middle of the country. So there was something we could do about that. But as Issachar says, killing suspected terrorists who happen to be Americans is not an assassination. Okay? In the department's view, a lethal operation conducted against U.S. citizens whose conduct poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States would be a legitimate act of national self-defense that would not violate assassination ban. Here's the problem. Jesse James is wanted dead or alive. So you're telling me that we cannot kill this guy? I mean, the man that killed him, he got a bonus. He was wanted dead or alive, and he was $10,000 or something for killing Jesse James. So they were paying the people to do it. So this is a double standard what they're talking about here. He said, although Attorney General Eric Holder told the public in March that killing Americans could be justified if government officials determined the target posed an imminent threat of violent attack, his memo creates a massive loophole. It contains a chilling little phrase, broader concepts of imminence, to absolve the government of responsibility to find a clear and present danger. The condition that an operational leader presents an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on a U.S. person and interest will take place in the immediate future. Of course not. Jesse James was wanted dead or alive. Not because we knew he was coming to rob another train or another bank. He was wanted dead or alive. Kill the man on sight or bring him in if you can. So I don't think anything here about targeted killings is not correct. Issachar further goes on, this is not an abstract theory. We're already killing our own in the name of war. Under Obama, the anti-war candidate who campaigned against Bush's trimming of U.S. civil liberties, the United States has escalated a number of drone strikes against al-Qaeda suspects, including deadly strikes on American citizens, such as the 2011 strike in Yemen that killed alleged al-Qaeda operative Anwar al-Awlaki and Samara Khan. They were U.S. citizens who had not been indicated or indicted or charged with crimes. You might wonder whether Democrats who accused Bush of attacking the Constitution will hold Obama to a similar standard. It will also be interesting to watch the Republicans who oppose virtually everything Obama's policy says will fight this one. It will be very funny. Let's see how they fight this one. Because I'm telling you something right now. They can't have their cake and eat it too. Now, here's some questions that are posed. Where does this slippery slope end? If killing Americans with no due process is okay, when their alleged crime is consorting with al-Qaeda, it's not a huge intellectual leap to give government officials the same judge and jury authority over other horrendous acts such as mass murder, drug trafficking, and child pornography. Well, the problem is they already have it. A mass murderer can be killed on site. Because I'm telling you, if he's on the FBI Most Wanted list, read the small print. It says wanted dead or alive. And it said that since we were a nation growing up. Tombstone had these pictures with these people's faces on it all the time. Wanted, $5,000, $10,000, dead or alive. So this, to me, this is laughable. I can't see where anything the president is doing is out of the ordinary. And you're telling me all these drug dealers, the cartels from Mexico, they're all wanted dead or alive. Every one of them, every last one of them. The next thing he says, shouldn't there be a higher standard? Yes, in a perfect world, there always wants to be a higher standard, and we always need to strive for a higher standard. But in certain places, in certain times, we cannot. In the torture debate, many Americans seem to buy the concept that extreme measures might be necessary to prevent an imminent attack against the U.S. Should the standard be higher for torture than murder? Well, the problem is, torture has been a hidden word. If, to me, personally, torture is not the same as murder. Now, if you wind up dead from the torture, same thing. So I think that's a red herring that they threw in there. The Isikoff is thrown in it. Number three, what makes the targeted killing lawful? Holder told the public months ago that killing Americans can be justified if capture is not feasible. But the memo gives more leeway to government officials condoning the killing of an American if the U.S. troops would be put at risk in an attempted capture, for example. This is not doublespeak. Why should we have more Americans killed to get one person? And then you can't tell me, oh, just let him go up and forget about him. He's killing American soldiers. Or his group, through his leadership, is killing Americans. This makes no sense to me. This is not doublespeak. Extreme measures in war are necessary sometimes. In war. Now, as I go back to my original statement, are we at war? Are we at war? See, this is what I want to know. Are we at war? If we're not at war, then what are we? It's a guerrilla war, as I said. To me, one American soldier's life is more then I would want to give up, not to get a terrorist. And if it takes sending a drone in there, then so be it. We know the guerrillas, a lot of them are cowards. Some of them are not cowards. They really believe it's justifiable. But when you start hiding behind your family and women, then it becomes a little dicey to say whether or not you're a coward or not. The whole New Orleans gang didn't hide out with women in the town, and they hid out in the whole war. They had their own hideout. They were murderers and robbers. They were wanted dead or alive. Isikoff also writes, why the secrecy? Obama promised to run the most transparent administration of modern times. And in many ways, he's kept that pledge. But not on this life and death issue. A group of 11 senators led by Democrat Ron Wyden of Oregon has urged the president to release all Justice Department memos on targeted killings. There are many more and more important documents than the Isikoff memo that need to be exposed. The public deserves to know why its president, without due process or visibility, is issuing death sentences to alleged terrorists, some of them Americans. They learned today that the public statements of administrative officials on this matter can't be trusted. Well, I like Michael Isikoff. I like, this is the first thing that he wrote that I disagree with him with. I don't remember anything else I've ever read that Isikoff has written that I disagree with. This, I completely disagree. He does not give a good answer in these four talking points of why we shouldn't have targeted killings. Every single thing here we have done since the Wild West was here. John Dillinger was wanted dead or alive. You could have shot John Dillinger in the street without due process, and they did shoot him in the street without due process in an alleyway. You remember? How come he was an American citizen? And by the way, most of these people here who Isikoff is talking about gave up, renounced their citizenship. Okay? But they shot John Dillinger. Okay? Whole bunch of people, the FBI's most wanted list, have been shot. So what are we talking about here? This is not done? It's always been done. And saying that he's an American citizen is no justification. That's a cop-out because you have nothing else to say. This is to make you feel that we're not holier than thou. We're not holier than thou. We are not holier than thou. And there is to prove to you, I want to just run you this little segment here about why. It's a short segment from the Great Story Newsroom.
I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world?
Well, Lewis and Sharon said it, diversity and opportunity and freedom and freedom.
I'm not letting you go back to the airport without answering the question.
Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing.
You don't look satisfied. One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you. What about the people? Why is America
not the greatest country in the world, Professor? That's my answer.
You're saying
yes.
Let's talk about
fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of our paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it any time he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. If liberals are so fucking smart, how come they lose so goddamn always?
Hey.
And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is, there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only three categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yosemite?
Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars, acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. Enough?
Well, is that enough? Or is it not enough? When we take it as a whole, we can't beat up this president because he does 1,000 out of 1,005 things that we want him to do. Can't act that way. That's completely ludicrous. This man has had more burdens put on his shoulders than any president in the history of this country outside of Washington and Lincoln. And if you have ever fought in any war, and you're going to tell me that you do not want your president protecting you with every single thing that he has in his arsenal, well, you're a fool. So I take exception to what Michael Isikoff has said in this so-called secret memos. We've been targeting people for assassination and killing since the dawn of man. President Obama didn't come out with the FBI's most wanted list. That was out long before he was even a gleam in his parents' eye. Bad people, FBI most wanted list. Wanted, dead or alive, American citizens. So don't tell me because these American citizens are overseas now that they're still not targeted. They're still wanted, dead or alive. And if you renounce your citizenship, hey, forget it. That's your problem. All I know is when I was over in Vietnam, I was glad we had everything that we could throw at these people. Even though it may not have been a good war. But as I said before, you're going into fight. You ain't going into fight with one hand tied behind you. You're going in to win. And win means that the other guy loses. And if he has any other friends around with him that can help him, they have to lose also. Yes, and sometimes there is collateral damage, just like the 3,000 people that died in the World Trade Centers. So just think about that. We have another Vietnam vet. Gracious Corner.
Hey there.
So, I don't know if you heard any of my rampage.
I heard your rant. You know I like to listen to your rant. It's always fun.
Well, I was talking about the Michael Isikoff piece that just came out, and I never disagree with Michael Isikoff, but I completely disagree with him now because I'm telling you, as someone who was in the military and has seen people die and seen people have soldiers not having enough backup. My brother was trapped on a mountain at Pleiku, and they did everything to fight to get off that mountain, and he was one of the lucky ones that did get off that mountain. So, you can't go, when you go into fight, you don't go in to lose, you don't go in to tie.
That's right. That's right.
You go in.
That's exactly
and,
right.
And if they're acting like we've never targeted American citizens without due process before. Well, you got to ask John Dillinger that, because they shot his butt down in an alleyway.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. This wanted dead or alive was Hoover started that. Well, no, Hoover didn't even start that. That was back in the may have been the Wild Earth. I mean, they've always had water posters wanted dead or alive. They were American citizens.
Yeah.
They gave whatever his name is, who shot Jesse James in the back. They gave him money for shooting Jesse James. He was wanted dead or alive. So what are we talking about here? And he said, well, they're saying that there was a loophole where if we think he's thinking about doing something, we can kill him. Well, if he's out there, he's thinking about doing something. I mean, he's not relaxing in a bunker. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, what, before we get into it, what do you think about that?
Great. I love Rachel Maddow, and I generally agree with her. But last night she went into this whole thing about the drones and, that kind of thing. And here, my thought is this. My thought is, look, first of all, we're targeting Al-Qaeda. Okay, we're killing the bad guys at no risk to American lives. I'm having a little problem understanding why people are so upset. Then I thought to myself, I understand. They're thinking about collateral damage. Well,
yeah.
You know what? There's collateral damage. There would be collateral damage even if there was not a drone strike, even if this was a manned strike. But when you have a man strike, you also then compromise the life of the American soldier and the American pilot. You know, so, you know, it comes down to this whole thing about war is hell. It is hell. And that's the reason why we need Chuck Hagel, because he will definitely take a tremendous, he will look at it real long and hard before he advocates for war.
Well, see, and the
back to that.
Yes, and that's the thing why the Republicans don't want him.
No. Yeah.
You know, they want somebody in there that's going to be telling the president, go on, go.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. This man was a grunt. He was a grunt. He wasn't sitting on in some office somewhere. He wasn't sitting on an aircraft carrier somewhere safe. He wasn't sitting someplace. This man was a grunt in the jungle.
That's right. That's
but
right.
He
makes
knows
him.
What it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing with General Wesley Clark, another
that's
grunt
right.
in the jungle. I mean, these people have seen the bullets fly at them, and they've been hit by the bullets.
Yep.
It's very easy for someone to say, oh, you know, why are we doing this? You know, is there a feasibility of capture? Well, no, there ain't no feasibility of capture.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
the only reason why we got Osama bin Laden is because that the country that he was in didn't want to make out that they knew he was there, so therefore they did not surround him with military. Or else he would have been surrounded by military. But then there would have been a terrorist state. See, so, that portion we could go in and give him with a targeted, which was at great risk, because I think there was only three people in his cabinet that went along with him with this, with the president, and all the rest of the people, Hillary Clinton, the DOD chief, everybody said, no, we need to stand off and shoot something at him. But, you know, so the president made the right decision there, and people need to understand that this isn't targeted killing. These are people who are on the most wanted list.
That's right. If we're not, and this is, that's, you see, again, you know, I love Rachel. She's great.
Yeah.
But I really, yesterday, I had to take issue with this.
Well, I did. And it's just like targeting Al Capone, but not targeting his number one man. I mean, that's completely, it's beyond all imagination. Well, I want to hear, because I already heard, but everybody else hasn't heard, what has happened? So what are you running for president of the United States? In 2016 or 14? When are you running?
Oh, come on, man.
Come on. I mean, I just want to ask the question. I mean, because, 9-3, that's even worse than Obama beat the Mixer.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing.
You need to consider running for president.
The thing is that it was so egregious. The claims were so egregious. The claims were so ridiculous. I mean, and so it was petty that it wasn't, and honestly, goodness, was not that difficult to see through. But the unfortunate thing is that you had somebody up there. I mean, June Navy was she was ready. She was convinced that I was going to get thrown out of office. But the problem, here's the problem I have with June, and I'm mentioning her name, okay? She whatever. But here's the problem I have with her. She had a problem with me. You know, she used to be woman enough to come to me and talk to me face to face, woman to woman.
You're just too sassy. Please, I don't want to deal with you.
Don't get somebody else to do your damn dirty work for you. Pardon my French. I'm sorry, God, forgive me. But don't get somebody else to do your dirty work for you. You know what I mean? Come face me, woman to woman. And this is what she didn't do. She did not do it. And so whatever respect I may have had for it is gone.
Absolutely. Here's what I want to know. Why? Why? Why?
You know, I believe that my belief, and along with many other people's beliefs, is that it all stemmed from that time when, you know, with the David Crockett debacle. when she started spreading the story that it was the Council of State that was setting David Parker up as a scapegoat because the Council of State wanted to steal his money, you know, the death checkoff money, which, and I called her on it, and I said, that's a lie, and you need to retract that, because, first of all, number one, it's a lie, number two, look and think of what you're doing. These are the same people. Now, remember, she started this back in January, February, March of last year. These are the same people we need to get elected in the fall. No?
Right.
So that gives the impression to everybody, the entire electorate, that we, the Democratic Party, are just crazy up in arms that we don't know what we're doing. And we lost. We lost bad. Now, I'm not blaming it completely on her, but I sure am blaming it on the fact, you know, this lack of cohesiveness. And yeah, she had a lot to do with it. It's not completely her fault, but she had a lot to do with it. You
well,
know?
The state chair had more to do with it.
Well, but my thing is they need to, they've got to understand. Everybody has to understand that there is just so much any one person can do. You know?
Well, but before you go on, I just want to know. I mean, state chair, what Democratic convention, what any convention, Republican or Democrat, do you know of that had a convention in the state and did not have the state chair opening the convention?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Is there something wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
I mean, is there something wrong? Am I looking at this wrong? What the heck? I mean, why? There had to be a reason that the Democratic National Committee said, hell no. So therefore, we're looking at a problem right there. Now, but I think it's more than that now. Why they put the problem on you, doesn't it have something to do with Mr. Larry Kissel?
It has a lot to do with Mr. Larry Kissel, yes. And that is also another thing.
So explain to us.
Okay. Well, Mr. Larry Kissel I was annoyed with him because he voted against the health care reform back in 2009. But he did promise that he would not vote to repeal it. So after a lot of soul searching and angst on my part, I agreed, okay, I would support Larry. But then last year, after the primary, and I remember Marcus Williams primaried Larry, okay, and Larry won. Well, I said, okay, he's our candidate, and I will support him. But then, after the primary, he comes out publicly and says that he will not support the president. He will not endorse President Obama, and he wasn't going to show up to the Democratic National Convention.
And what was his reason? What was his reasoning for saying he would not support the president?
He didn't really say. But he also voted to hold Eric Holder in contempt of Congress, which is unprecedented in our history. And it was clearly a partisan move. So he voted with Republicans to hold Eric Holder in contempt. Oh, well, that also just rubbed me the wrong way. So that, plus saying he was not going to support our president, was not going to endorse our president, that really, really, really bothered me. Then, the icing on the cake, he decides he's going to vote to repeal health care. And he said if reelected, he would work to repeal Obamacare. Well, when he did all of these things, I came right out and said, you know what, if you cannot support the president, well, let me put it this way. I had a debate with myself. Do I support Larry Kissel or do I support my president? Well, guess what? It didn't take long. I support my president.
You mean you didn't have to think about that overnight or something like that?
No, that was a nanosecond of a debate.
Okay. Now, isn't there some sort of rule or part of the Democratic National Committee that says you must support the president and vice president or you can be removed?
The DNC bylaws and constitution, which supersedes all other plans of all the states, stipulate very clearly that, first of all, members of the DNC. Okay, mm-hmm. and then stipulates that members of the DNC must support the President and the Vice President of the United States, and that if they do not, it further stipulates that within 30 days of the convention, they will be removed. They will be asked to go away. Okay, so Larry Kissel, being an elected member of Congress, was a member of the DNC, and he violated that specific rule. So my thing is, well, if he was not told to go away, why am I being told to go away? That didn't make any sense.
Well, the thing is, so next question is, why didn't the DNC drop him? And the only explanation I can come up with, I'll listen to yours after you hear mine, is that they were too far down the rabbit hole with this man.
They were too far down the rabbit hole, but they did actually drop him because that $1.1 million that they were going to
right.
take to his campaign, they took that
off.
Back. Yeah, they cut it
well.
Off. So they did, actually. Yeah.
So therefore, and the other thing is that they okayed the, or was it the state, or was it the national party that okayed Mayor
Antonio
Blue?
Yes. 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 Yes.
So
they did not turn their back on him. Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, that should have been a clear sign. I mean, to anybody that can even read or hear that there was a problem here.
Well, see, the slippery slope that we could have gone down is that if they were successful in removing me as chair of the county because I supported Antonio Blue, who was a Democrat, by the way. I did not support someone from another party. Okay, their argument is that by me supporting Antonio Blue, another Democrat, I was in bed with the enemy. Okay, well, you can reverse that argument and say that by supporting Larry Kissel, who is a Democrat, they were also in bed with the enemy because they were taking away votes from Antonio Blue. So, the argument doesn't hold any water. Does not hold water at all.
And the thing is that if they knew this. So
yeah.
This is the state party. So we're talking about the state party chair. We're talking about, now, how many other chairs supported?
I can't even begin to tell you. I believe out of the 13 counties, maybe about 9 or 10.
Supported? So therefore, why weren't any of those district chairs brought up in charges?
There's the rub, ain't it? There's the rub. There you go.
So,
you just put your finger on the button.
So therefore, they were out after little old you.
So now
tell us how this went down now. Well, how did these charges, how were they presented?
Well, okay, initially 7 people signed, but they were lied to and they were intimidated. So immediately the day after the 7 people signed, 2 withdrew immediately. As it went along, 2 others withdrew, so you ended up with 5, okay, with end up with 3 people. So out of the 7, 4 withdrew. You wound up with 3 people. So you got 3 people.
What were these people told to why they should support removal of you as the chair of Cabarrus County?
Well, you see, I don't know. I can't tell you what they were told, but I can tell you that the petty arguments that they had, you know, one of the arguments was that I was rude to her. One of Janet Haber said, I was rude to her and that I didn't return her phone calls.
Hold on a minute. I'm looking through the North Carolina Democratic Party plan of organization,
yes. Okay.
And see,
uh-huh.
I'm seeing where it says being rude is a removal.
Not returning phone calls, right.
I don't see that here.
It's not there.
It's not
but
there.
There was pettiness. And so these petty arguments that were being placed, okay, is reasons for me to be removed were clearly petty. But instead of, and their advisor was June Mabry. I can tell you that because David Ford told me that June Mabry was their advisor. He told me that. Not just me, but he told several other people in a meeting that they got, June Mabry was always available for advice and for counsel, and they called her, and she, so she was their advisor. She should have said to them, this is petty. Okay, we need to drop it. But in fact, instead of that, she encouraged them. And again, this is what I was told by the
prosecutor. I'm trying to understand. You're telling me now, we have some grown adults here. And you're telling me these grown adults called up other grown adults and said, I want to get rid of her because I don't like her shoes.
Actually, this started with June calling them and giving them the option of the petition to remove and then telling them how to do it. She advised them every step of the way. Again, I'm telling you, I know this because it came straight from their mouths. This is not innuendo anymore. They admitted it. If they admitted it, then I guess it's true.
Now this petition was brought forth, and it was presented to who?
It was sent to David Parker. That's where it goes first. It goes to David Parker. At that point in time, it was David Parker. Okay.
Now, wait a minute. But you're the chair of Cabarrus County.
Right.
How could they, whoever they are, in Cabarrus County, or was it Cabarrus County, or was it the 8th District?
It was in Cabarrus County.
Okay, Cabarrus. How could they in Cabarrus County send a letter to the chair complaining about you without you getting a copy of the letter beforehand?
Yeah, I didn't have a copy of that. I found out by accident.
So, I mean, they're asking him to remove you without asking you to straighten out whatever you've done.
Correct. Correct.
So they didn't want to negotiate. They just want you gone.
That's right.
All right, so that's illegal right there on the face of it. All right, so continue. Continue the story.
Okay.
So he sent to Parker, and then what?
So it goes to Parker, and then Parker, along with quote-unquote elected members of the State Executive Council, review the petition to see if there's any merit. Well, these are people that David Parker could select, all right, to be, and so it wasn't difficult for him to get
what you're telling me, this sounds like a grand jury investigation.
Oh, no, honey, it was a kangaroo court. Never mind the
grand jury. I'm saying grand jury because it was all secret.
Yeah.
I mean, that aspect of it. And this is not supposed to be secret because we've got the sunshine law here. So this should not have been anything presented to anybody without first you getting something.
Well, you know, the thing of it is that I was not supposed to know anything about it until I got the letter from the Council of Review. Yeah.
That's wrong on the face of it. I have been to many council reviews, and you know long in advance what the petitioners have said because you get a copy.
Well, I finally did. Again, I got a copy by accident to start with. Everything worked out. It was unprecedented. The nefarious plot was unprecedented.
Nefarious.
Okay, this is the first time the Council of Review has ever heard a petition to remove. The first time. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So what happened when you got up there, which was last Saturday?
Last Saturday. When I got up there, there were 28 other people in the room, my witnesses. They had none.
The others had none.
There were the three petitioners. And that was it. They had none. Everyone else in that room was a witness for me. okay? So, yeah. And the three people, it was a 9-3 vote, and I can pretty much assure you that the three that voted to remove me were from the 8th District, and they were people that were fans of Drew Mabry.
Unbelievable.
So here's what happened on Saturday. Randy Bowler was running for chair. Okay, there was a stealth move to place Bob Etheridge's name on the floor. Okay, to nominate him from the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I find out that one of the people behind the stealth move is Drew Mabry. Okay, here we go. Here's another stealth move. Now, Randy, I love Bob Etheridge. Don't get me wrong. I love Bob. I think Bob Etheridge is great. Absolutely great. But what I don't appreciate is Randy Bowler had worked so hard, so very hard, and he had been all over the state, and he had talked to people, and you know, and I talked to him, and I appreciated everything that Randy had said and everything that Randy was willing to work for and work with in the party. And he proved himself to me by what he did in his county. Okay, in his county, he got more Democrats registered, more Democrats to vote. I mean, look.
What county is he from?
Pitt.
He's from Pitt County, okay.
Pittsburgh. He's the mayor of Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. So he's the mayor of Pittsburgh, too. Okay.
Yeah, he's mayor of Pittsburgh. So he's a really, I mean, I appreciated him. I really appreciate what he did and what he is continuing to do. And as chair of the North Carolina Democratic Party, I know he'll do the best he can for us. I know he will. So having said that, you know, if Bob Etheridge had won from being nominated from the floor, I would have supported Bob. I mean, there's no question about it. There's no question. It would have been good. But the icing on the cake is that Drew Mabry lost twice on Saturday. Okay? The petition from the floor for Bob Etheridge failed. And the petition to remove me failed. This woman was spitting nails as far as people were telling me she was spitting nails. She was so mad. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay.
Yep.
But what I hope the lesson that is learned is that it is so much better to work in direct sunlight. It is so much better to work with reaching your hand across the aisle and negotiating and talking. Okay, underhanded Republican, these are Republican underhanded, you know, actions are not welcome in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope people understand that. And I hope that if Mabry is listening, she hears me loud and clear. It's rude. What she did was rude.
Well, you see, that is correct, but I'm just trying to understand why. I mean, you can't ask somebody to be removed because you don't like their shoes or their coat or their smile. It's clearly spelled out in the plan of organization what someone can be removed for.
Well, this is true, and they failed in improving because they're saying I didn't fulfill my role as chair, and their rationale for me not fulfilling my role as chair was I didn't answer phone calls, that I was rude, that, you know, excuse me, wait a minute. If people get removed for not answering phone calls, then David Falk should have been removed a long time ago, and Tammy Brunner, too. You know,
if that's
the rationale, I mean, give me a break.
If that's the case, I should be divorced. My wife keeps saying, you never return my calls. Every time you're on the phone, you go, people say, I get 250 emails a day. How the heck am I supposed to answer every email? Forget it. They think it must be crazy. But we need to understand, and this is my belief, we lost North Carolina because of this debacle.
That's right.
We lost North Carolina because it was very close. And I think that if David Parker would have been a good Democratic chair and would have been out there with the people and on the side of the DNC, the DNC siding with him, it would have been a lot closer, or we could have won, even though they redistricted.
Mm-hmm.
because we didn't lose by that amount that we should have lost. People were so turned off about what happened the last 2 years in this state. That's why they didn't turn. I think the voter turnout is one of the lowest, isn't it?
Well, you know, the thing of it is, you're right. You're absolutely right. When we talk to people afterwards, okay, this is what they told me. I mean, I just did an informal survey of people in Cabarrus County, people that ordinarily would have voted Democratic or independent that would ordinarily didn't. And the reason they did is because they said, you're a party in disarray. We don't like this. We don't like what we're seeing. You guys are fighting within yourselves.
That's right.
They don't like seeing that. And so the Republicans won.
And a lot of them were independents. And, you know, and I can say right now, Mecklenburg County, when we were redistricted, because if you don't win Mecklenburg County by a substantial amount, you don't win the state. And when they lost, I think, 30 out of 32 seats, or 32 out of 32 precincts, and they did not contact those people, the Democratic Party from the state, they didn't care. The people, they lost interest. I know many a person that told me, I never got anything from the state. The state ignored us. I mean,
yep.
What are you going to say?
Yep. Happened all the time.
Well, now, the next thing I want to know is, when are you running for the chair of the party? It's got to be up. Let's see, you were just elected, so that's 2 years. That means, 13, what's that, 15?
Yeah.
Okay. So who's on
I'm exploring my options.
Where is the exploratory? Now, I know you have this exploratory campaign stealthily coming together now. I know you have the contacts all in the 8th District. I know there are plenty of people here in Mecklenburg County that would support you. All they need is just a little pushy.
I am exploring all of my options. Now, I stepped down as chair of Cabarrus County in April, and I'm going to devote my time 100% to grassroots building and grassroots movement. Because we need to turn North Carolina blue. Okay, that is what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be working with veterans issues, and you know how close that is to my heart.
Yep.
You also know that veterans vote. Veterans vote. We vote.
Yes.
So that is where I'm going to focus all my energy. We have to, and that is all I'm going to say for now.
Well, no, you just
but
can't
you know,
let us stand like
I'm
that.
Gonna,
you
I
can't let it hang like that.
Look, I promise you this, though. I promise you this. Whenever I make a decision, I will announce it on the Michael Lawson Show.
Oh, that would be wonderful, but
seriously,
try to dodge the issue here. Now, I know, first of all, let's go this route. Who's in the running for Cabarrus County Chair when you step down?
You know, the nominating committee is meeting, and they have not put forth a slate yet. But we do have some excellent candidates. We really do. There's excellent people, yes. Very strong, very progressive, just really good people. And that was one of the key things. Okay, we're hearing for the old guard, we're hearing, oh, we need somebody moderate, middle of the road. But no, we don't. We need some real Democrats. We need some serious progressives. So that's where we're going. We're looking at Democrats.
So you're actually telling us that you are actually going to step down, or are you term limited? Or what?
No. I am going to step down. I'm going to step down, and I'm stepping down because I have other bigger fish to fry.
So you're going to be announcing the same time as Hillary?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Well, that's wonderful. And you'll be making that announcement right here on the last word.
Anytime there is a change in my plans, you will be the first to know, Michael.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Now, how big an audience was it up there at the convention?
would be. It would be. I think we had a full complement of SEC members.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And when is the organizing, the reorganizing of the precincts? When does that start?
That starts March the, hold on, I'm going to tell you, it's March the 3rd, March the 3rd to the 16th. So we have a two-week window for precinct organization. Okay.
I thinking it was February 15th or something.
No.
Okay.
March 3rd through the 16th, our convention is going to be on April the 13th, and then, of course, we've got the county convention, which is the district convention, which is going to be on May the 18th.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There we are.
That May the 18th, that's the district convention. That's the 8th district convention.
Now,
what are the counties in the 8th district now, since they redistricted?
Oh, my gosh, they're 13. I'm going to try to remember all of them, but I try to commit it to memory. The same 10, and then you add Randolph, Davidson, and Rowan.
Okay. Well, isn't Robeson is one of them, right? Or is they, yeah.
Robeson is still one of them, right? So we've got Anson, Richmond, Scotland. You know, I just pulled it up yesterday to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to have to memorize this thing. But there are 13 counties, which is pretty much
absolutely. In your run, you'll have to go to every one of them counties.
Oh, absolutely. we'll do all of that. So.
Now we have also. Isn't there still in place, I was speaking to Reverend Edward Hales from the Advancement Project just before you came on in Washington, and he was said that there is still the suit going on here in North Carolina about the redistricting. Now, what do you think the chances are of that being overturned and everything put back to where it was?
You know, I have high hopes. I really have high hopes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was done before the Republicans
mm-hmm.
tried this before, and it was rejected, and everything returned back to where it was. Right.
Okay, here we go. The district 8, Anson, Montgomery, Richmond, Scotland, Stanley, portions of Cabarrus, portions of Davidson, Mecklenburg, Randolph, Robeson, Rowan, and Union.
Portions of Mecklenburg.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm no longer in it. I want to get back in it.
That means that, you know, Mecklenburg gets to vote twice. Three times, because part of Mecklenburg's in the ninth, too.
That's right. But mm-hmm. I would like to get back in it so I could run for an 8th district chair again.
Oh, you know what? You need to scooch. Hurry up.
Because I was the 8th district chair before.
You need to hurry up and scooch in and move, man.
Well, I want to tell you, this has been a great feat and a great. This is democracy, how it really works.
Yeah.
It doesn't run by the scurrilous and underhanded backroom like Tammany Hall anymore.
Backroom deals just don't do it. You know?
Right. Yeah. Well, we've had enough of them. With the Republican Party trying to change the way we vote for the Electoral College and by keeping people out from voting, cutting voting days, et cetera. So I'm glad to see this has worked out all right, and it's worked out great for the Democratic Party. Now we just need to make sure that people understand that because Barack Obama was elected in 2008, there was not going to be a chicken in every single pot. That you had to go out and buy the chicken. There were more chickens available in the store, but you had to go out and buy the chicken.
You got to.
So
you know?
We cannot let the president is FDR said one time. Well, you want this? You want this? Make me do it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make sure by going out and voting that we make him do it. The president doesn't pass any laws. All he does is sign it.
Yep.
That's all he does. And we're in a pickle for the next 10 years because people did not get out and vote. They didn't get off their butts and vote. And that's why we have that no-count Pat McCrory in the office of governor.
Yep.
And people are really going to see how much it really hurts. And I don't want to hear anybody calling up here crying about what they're doing, because they're most likely the one that didn't vote. So I want to thank you, my dear.
You're very welcome.
And we're going to make sure that you have enough money to run for the chair of the Democratic.
I appreciate you so very much. You cannot begin to know.
And
thank you.
We will make sure. We'll see you, next week.
Yeah.
I will be out of town. I'll be in Charleston this weekend having some crab and some shrimp.
Okay.
All right.
Well.
But this show will be aired Friday as normal.
Very good.
You say, kiss the baby. Say hello to your hubby. And I'll see you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that was Grace's Corner, Grace Leem Galloway, who took the people to task who tried to get rid of her because she was only following her president. Those people did not want her to follow the standard bearer of this party. They didn't want her to follow the vice chair of this party, Barack Obama and Joe Biden, respectively. How could anybody, I don't care who you're voting for, if you don't vote for your president or your vice president, and you're a member of that party, that's fine, because you should not be able to say, I have to vote for this person because this is a dictatorship and they're telling me to do so. But when someone who's a member of your party, who's an elected official in your party, who says that he's not going along with the president, the standard bearer of the party, or the vice president of the party, because of an issue that was completely a lie, because the issue that Larry Kissel said was the president stole $716 billion out of Medicare, which was an absolute outright lie. He didn't steal any money to put into Obamacare. The money he's taken from the insurance companies was coming out of the insurance companies, was not coming out of any services in Medicare. It was coming out of the profits that the insurance companies make. Yes, that's right. They make, you don't know how many billions upon billions upon billions upon billions upon billions of dollars the insurance company makes above and beyond. That's why now with Obamacare, with the Affordable Care Act, the insurance company has to pay you back money if they don't put 80% of all the premiums that you spend, that they charge you, if they do not spend out of every $100, $80 on your health care, they got to send that money back to you. I bet you a lot of you people out there didn't know that. I bet you a lot of you people out there didn't know that they take care of more things now. Why don't you call up your insurance company and ask them for a new booklet on what they take care of now and compare it to the old booklet if you still have it? You'll see a lot of things. And by 2014, a lot more are going to be built in because it's not even Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act is not even fully implemented yet. It's not even fully implemented. So then you ask, well, why are the insurance companies doing this? Isn't it costing them a lot of money? No. Because they have built-in formulas to protect them. Insurance companies never lose. They could pay free health care for every other person in the country, and they still wouldn't be losing. Because insurance companies are in the business to make money. They're not in the business of losing. So this is what you need to understand about this. This is what you need to understand about this. And let me take a few minutes out. I was just distracted by my neighbor chasing his dog up and down the block here. there is a old saying that... he just fell down. he just fell down chasing the dog. All right. We're going to have our next guest coming on, who is guest next two guests, which was the interview I had with the president of the Charlotte branch of the NAACP, Reverend Kojo Mentambu, and Eric Rodriguez from Action North Carolina. And as a matter of fact, we're going to look for that right now. And it was a interview that I had with them yesterday afternoon, and it was a part of a three-parter. It's in reference to the HK on J, which will be taking place Saturday, February 9th, starting at 9:30 at Shaw University in Raleigh. And they're going to be marching all the way down to the assembly. And just like to read this. Reverend Barber said, "We suffer attention, violence towards poverty. We are in crisis, moral, political, economic. But when we see faces of poverty and hear voices of poverty, we can come together to change the institutional realities that sustain the system of poverty. Anything less renders suspect our claim that our values come from our faith and from our Constitution." That's Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, who is the president of the North Carolina chapter of the NAACP. And the, as I said, this is the 7th annual March on Jones Street, and you still can, you can still call to find out to see if you get right on one of the buses. You can call, Reverend Kojo at 704-334-7853, or you can call Louis Rodriguez, who's the community organizer of Action Coalition, at 704-625-4050. They will be leaving, I believe he said, at 6 o'clock, and I don't remember where, but they will be leaving at 6 o'clock a.m. From the over at the university area here in Charlotte, at the in the old Walmart parking lot in university. Another number for Reverend Kojo is 704-599-8904. So if you want to be on there, on the bus going up there, it's going to be a great trip. They're going to have a food bus with you, but eat a good breakfast before you leave. It might be cold, but I understand it's going to be kind of warm this towards the afternoon on Saturday. So I believe they said they would be back in town in Charlotte by 6. So it's a three-hour ride, so at least. So why don't you all try to make it up there? And right now, I am going to, if I can find this thing here. Oh, yeah, I saw it right over here. This is the interview I had with Reverend Kojo and Eric Rodriguez. I think you're going to enjoy it. This is the last word. It's Friday, February the 8th, 2013. And I'm here with the president of the NAACP Charlotte branch, Reverend Kojo Nantambu.
No.
I keep
Nantambu.
Nantambu. Nantambu. Ah, I get
right,
it.
It's all right.
But he's the president of the Charlotte branch of the NAACP. And he's also the pastor of the Green Oak Missionary Baptist Church here in Charlotte. And along with the Reverend is Luis Rodriguez, who is a community organizer for Action North Carolina. And Reverend, tell us, why are we here at this final, final week before HKNJ? What does HKNJ mean? This is the seventh year. What does it mean to North Carolina, to the NAACP, and, well, to all its people in North Carolina?
It means action. It means involvement, engagement. It means an opportunity to express the people's views concerning their local as well as their state officials. But most of all, there's an opportunity for people to come together from all over the state. The week after the General Assembly has been put in session to address the policies and the issues that are being exercised and implemented by these officials at the expense, at the oppression of the masses. And the reason why I say the expense and oppression of the masses is because in the last couple of years, it appears that most of the policies that are being implemented are against the poor, are against the masses, and have no real connection with what the people put them in office for. And so HKOJ comes together with 140 different partners from around the state, and we have this big march to cast their attention on the General Assembly so people can see this is where your government functions. This is where your people come to make laws that either represent you or misrepresent you. And by doing that, we cause people to get educated, to become aware of what is going on in their community, what's going on in their state. But it also gives them an opportunity to give them a venue to vent or to address or protest the issues that they don't like. At HKLJ this year, which is probably going to be the most, to me, is probably the most serious one we're going to have. And that's because this year we have a majority, a supermajority in the General Assembly, and along with the government, and they're beginning to implement policies that are very, very dangerous, not only for people of North Carolina, but for this country.
And this is the first time in like 120-something years that the Regressive Party has taken over the complete government.
That's right, in 120 years, first time. And what they're going to do, the first thing they're planning on doing is they're going to cut unemployment. They're going to cut unemployment. Unemployment money comes from the federal government, but they're going to cut unemployment because they say that the people...
Well, partial, because they can't cut it all from the federal government.
Because don't they get some sort of trade? The federal government gives X amount, and then they give X amount.
No, they're cutting it all. They're cutting what they want to cut, which anybody with good sense knows that's not what the masses want, because the masses are unemployed right now. But they're cutting it from $536 a week to $350 a week. And poverty says that anybody that's making $500 a week with a family of four is in poverty. So you can't make it. So if you give somebody $350 a week or less, there's no way they're going to be able to sustain.
And what's their reasoning for doing this?
Because they say that the people are just getting unemployment so they don't have to work. And the people that get unemployment can only get unemployment if they had a job beforehand.
So that's right. These people are actually getting stuff, getting monies that they already paid into.
That has already been paid into, and that is a result of their investment in a previous job.
That's correct.
You can't get unemployment just by going signing up. You will have to have worked at least 6 months to a year before you got it, which meant that's money that you already have helped invest into the unemployment.
Well, right now, how long is unemployment good for when you first started? How long can you be on unemployment?
Well, right now it was set up for 56 weeks, and they have been extending it for, 26 weeks. They've been extending it for 52 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
People have been able to get it for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're going to reduce it to unemployment. You won't be able to get but 12 to 20 weeks.
And
20 weeks max.
At a reduced rate.
At a reduced rate of $350 a week.
Okay, so what happens after the max 26 weeks?
At this particular time, it's up to the state whether or not you be reconsidered for another.
Oh, okay. So the state then decides.
Yeah.
Not the federal government.
No. The state makes this decision. And the General Assembly is writing in. They're trying to cut people off at 20 weeks. At this point, they've been talking about no extensions.
Where's this money that they're going to. If this is federal government money.
Yes.
The state can't use it for anything else.
No, they can't.
So they're just going to send it back to the government.
Send it back to the government. It's an issue.
So you're telling me they're sending money back to the government that ain't theirs.
That ain't theirs. That belongs to the masses. Belongs to those people who have worked, that have paid into unemployment, or the businesses they work for paid into unemployment security. But what happened was, in the 90s, the General Assembly of North Carolina decided to cut corporate and job investment into unemployment security. So they ran out of money during the economic downturn in 2008, 2009, and there's not enough money in there. So they had to borrow money from the federal government to pay unemployment for the last 3 or 4 years. They blamed that on the people who were unemployed and say that the only reason they was getting the money is because they didn't want to work. Well, this is the most ludicrous thing you ever heard of. So now the people are having to pay for something that they didn't even create, was created by the corporations and the businesses who cut unemployment security in investment. And so they're sending the money back, saying that the people don't deserve the money because all they're going to do is just go get, as you said earlier, go get some Grey Goose or something.
Grey Goose or the lottery tickets.
It's crazy. Yeah.
This is a problem that I have. The state doesn't contribute to unemployment at all then.
Yeah.
Okay. So they can, if the federal government says, okay, we want to send you $500,
right,
the state gets the option whether to accept $500 or not?
Yeah. They have the option.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah. They have the option to do
well,
that.
Well, so now with $350-something,
let me say this is very critical. This will bring $25 billion a week. Into a month, I think, into the state of North Carolina.
Right.
If those people were allowed to get their unemployment.
Right.
That helps the economy of North Carolina. These people are so vicious and mendacious, they would rather cut the money and destroy their own economy.
Well, you see, it's not hurting that 2%.
I know,
And as long as there's a black man in the White House, they don't care if the economy goes down the tube.
Exactly.
We have a ultra right wing racist regime that is in power now in about 33 states in this country.
Right.
And they don't care whether their people suffer or not, because they have made it plain in the last few years that it's only them.
That's
minorities
right.
that will suffer
right.
if we don't give it to them. You people will not suffer. And they, since these people only listen to one station, Fox News, and Rush Limbaugh, and Cheyenne Hattie, and O'Reilly, they already get that point of view.
That's it.
So those people, just like we talked about in Justified, you know, don't take my Social Security, don't take my, take theirs. You know, we don't care what you do, take theirs.
And it is so sad that the masses of our people are so uneducated and that themselves are so racist and bigoted that they don't see that whatever happens in Congress or in the General Assembly, whatever bills that are implemented to suppress or oppress one group is going to affect all of them. They haven't figured it out yet.
The problem is, though, the reason why they haven't figured it out is, well, you know, hey, they want to cut education. They do not want the masses educated.
No, they don't.
When the masses when the masses get educated,
they move up. Yes.
They start to peep the whole card of the other guy, the dealer.
Exactly.
So you need to put people in poverty, but you need to take education away from them first.
So they'll stay in poverty.
In poverty.
And then the other thing is they're going to cut, they're trying to get rid of affordable health care. They voted in the Senate last week to not accept affordable health care, which is Obamacare, which means that the hundreds of thousands, over 600,000 people won't have the availability to have insurance when they go to the hospital. This is free money as well.
Right.
This money does not come from the state of North Carolina. This comes from the federal government, from federal taxes. This money is being applied so that for people who normally cannot go to the doctor can go. This does not hurt the state of North Carolina. It does not take anything. But then along with that, out of the 1.7 million people in poverty in North Carolina, which is a phenomenal number, 40% of those are children, which means over 600,000 children will not have any means of getting health care.
Well,
right
now, how many people are on don't have health care, I should say?
About 1.7 million.
Okay. So, and right now, these people, when they get sick, you, I, and Luis here pay for them to go to the emergency room at a cost of quadruple the amount that if they went to a hospital, a doctor.
And affordable health care will relieve that burden from the state and from the state taxpayer. But they won't even accept that because they just want people
The problem is, though, these things were brought up originally by Republicans.
That's right. Exactly.
Years ago, this was the Republican mantra: we need to cut out people going to the emergency room.
Yeah.
I mean, it was Nixon, I believe, that came up with the Medicare.
Yeah.
Not Medicare, but the extension of the health program. It was Nixon, right?
Yeah.
So now we have a regime that is so outrageous and bodacious because there's a black man in office. They don't want people to have anything.
That's right.
Now, Luis, what is Action Coalition doing to get this message out? I know you're working with the NAACP and you're going to be part of this whole coalition on the 9th, as the last 7 years. Getting this information out. But what are they doing around the state of North Carolina as far as getting the message out about what is actually being done?
Thank you for the question. Action NC, we have offices here in Charlotte, also in Durham and in Raleigh. And one of the things that we've been doing for the past few weeks is we've had a statewide tour that's hit several cities. I know Raleigh, Wilmington, Greensboro, Asheville, Charlotte, where we are calling for Governor McCrory and members of his cabinet to take the 350 challenge and to live themselves for a week on $350.
In a cardboard box.
In a cardboard box.
On the corner of near Shaw University.
Yeah, not that they can find any housing. For that. As far as HKONJ, we are very happy to be a part of the 140 organizations that are helping to make this possible. We're very happy to have partnered with groups like the Urban League, some of the labor unions here, Democracy North Carolina, the NAACP here, all very dynamic, very forceful organizations out doing very good work. The HKMJ, you know, the reason why it's so necessary is, like Reverend Kojo was saying, education is sorely lacking. The powers that be like to do as much as they can in the shadows. They like to do as much as they can without public scrutiny or without public input into the process. As we've seen, you know, even though the governor has a supermajority at his back in Congress, they're still using it not to even hear alternative viewpoints on issues, just to ram things through, which shows us that they came into this with a definite agenda. They came into this with a game plan. They don't want anything to knock that game plan. And their game plan, really, you know, in a nutshell, is to put as little of the fiscal burden of running the state and running the programs that people need to survive, to take as much of that off of the shoulders of the wealthy, the corporations, those who can most afford to pay into it, and to put that onto the shoulders of the people who can least afford to pay into it, the people who are on fixed incomes, the elderly, children, people who are unemployed, people who have lower expectations because of lower educational opportunities to them. This is an attack on the people of North Carolina by an elite group at the top. And unless the people come together, educate themselves, and partner with one another, this attack will go undefended, and that will be, that could be an egregious blow to the people of North Carolina.
Well, you know, unless the people come together is a quite a statement, because the people didn't come together. That's why we're like this right now,
exactly,
in 2010,
exactly,
because they thought there was going to be a chicken in every pot when Obama got elected.
Right.
And the machine don't work by itself.
Right.
You have to constantly do your diligence. To keep the people that you elected,
right,
to do what you asked them to do.
But can I say something about,
yes,
it? I think one of the things is that our people, most of the people in this country, really trusted and still trust the government process, the electoral process. They still trust that if somebody is elected, when they get in office, they will represent and try to uphold the issues and represent the conditions and circumstances of the masses.
Well, that's a proven fact. That's why Obama got elected.
Right. That's why the people believe that. But what happened is we came into a generation, a group of people who had already for years had been planning to just totally ignore the needs of the masses, the concerns of the masses, even the people that put them in office, and to only concentrate and affect the issues, the demands, and the concerns of the very wealthy, to give them plight over the masses of the people, even though the Constitution of North Carolina and the United States says we the people.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't represent the people. They only represent special circumstances, special concerns, and special interest groups. And that's what's happened. But the masses of the people still trust the government. Unfortunately, that's a part of their naivety that I was speaking about. And they were complacent after the election of Obama because they felt, well, now we got somebody who's going to work for us and really help us. But at the same time, there were those who were working in the back rooms in the corner saying, no, that's never going to happen because we're going to make this country the way we want it to be, just those few, for the even fewer. And I think that's where we've fallen down is because now we have to come to the realization, can't nobody do for us but us. We have to continue to fight as the people, as a mass of people in every community, in every city, in every state. And we have to fight to make sure that our concerns are respected, but not only respected, but are considered and then moved upon.
Well, you know, this famous quote by FDR, he says, make me do it.
Yeah.
He 4 terms, he was in office, but he kept saying, you want it done? Make me do it.
And Obama said the same thing. Remember when Obama was pushing for the works bill, for the highway roads bill, the construction, the infrastructure bill.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm going to do this. He said, but y'all are going to have to make it work. In other words, he was telling the masses, y'all got to stand up and fight and let Congress know that y'all want this.
Absolutely correct.
And we haven't done that.
We have a problem right now in 2008 when he was elected. And then they kept saying, by 2010, we're disappointed in him.
Yeah.
He didn't do that, and
right.
He didn't do that. I mean, I don't think these people ever took civics or history in school.
Exactly.
The president can't do jack.
Nothing.
It's the Congress that makes laws.
That's right.
He only signs them.
Oh,
yeah, but he has the power. No, he don't have the power to make anybody do nothing.
That's right.
Nothing. And it's separate but equal is three branches of government. You need to understand
right.
that. And right now, people need to understand that we, the people, as the president said so many times in his inaugural address,
we, the people,
need to make this happen. We have a as they said, about 30 or 33 regressive
states.
Partnership states in this country that they control, and they all were up, or every one of them to the last man says, oh, we're not going to have Obamacare. Yeah, well, now we got Jan Brewer down in Arizona, a real knucklehead, says, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to take the Obamacare. Now we got Rick Scott down there,
yeah.
who should have been in jail for his Medicare fraud down there,
right.
but he controlled everything.
Yeah.
So, and he won't be governor again, but he's even going to take it. And he even said, he's like, oh, boy, you know, there really was a problem with this voting down there. I had nothing to do with it. Right. Okay. So anyway... He's taking it. They're all going to come on and take it because they can't look. You know, these people only see green.
Right, exactly.
And if they see this green going to everybody else,
to them, yeah.
they're going to take this Medicare.
Well,
because we're, well, not Medicare, the Obamacare. We have, as you said, about 1.7 million people who don't have health care. Okay, in North Carolina. That, out of a population of what, 13 million?
Oh, no, it's all about...
Oh, about 7 million?
Yeah, about 7
million.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one-seventh.
Yes.
I mean, more than one-seventh.
Yeah.
I mean, that is unbelievable in a state that was supposed to have the... You know, before 2000, North Carolina was number... two or three in education
mm-hmm.
in this entire country. We're now about 47.
Yeah, 47.
Mississippi
yeah. That's right.
is beating us.
That's right.
I mean, Mississippi.
Yeah.
I mean, this is so unbelievable. It's sickening.
And that's what makes HKLJ so prominent, so important, and so useful because it gives people an opportunity to really see where does this state stand in its ability to afford its people a meaningful, workable, productive, and prosperous life, the life with the pursuit of happiness, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have that right. We fight for that right. We work for that right. But yet we're being denied that right by a very few people.
Very few
people. And so HKLJ affords people opportunity to see what can be done. And the thing that we can do is come together as a community, come together as a city or a state, and fight against these kind of politics
mm-hmm.
and against these kind of politicians. And the most important thing it does is that it at least educates the masses on what these policies are, who put these policies into place, and what you can do to help reverse these policies
right.
and make sure that they're not effective.
Now, Friday, how's this whole thing going to kick off with the NAACP, your portion of it.
Right. Well, on Saturday, Friday night, I don't know if you're talking about, but Friday night,
right, Friday night
in Raleigh, there's going to be a big mass
right.
Community meeting. There's going to be a big worship service. You know everything.
Where's that going
to
be at?
To start off with a church service. That's going to be at Russ Metropolitan Memorial, AME Zion Church in Raleigh at 551 Cabarrus Avenue. Cabarrus Street. We're going to have a big service. Bishop Battle is going to be there. Bishop Hoyt with the CME is going to be there. Dr. Benjamin Chavis is going to speak, and many of our 140 partners are going to be there to speak. St- students from all over the state is going to be there. That's our kickoff. You know, everything we do is as a worship service. We've got to have invoke the Holy Spirit to bless us. And then that morning, we're going to meet at Shaw University at 9 o'clock, gathering from 9 o'clock to about 9:30. We'll step off about 10. We get to the General Assembly.
The march is going to start about 10.
The march starts about 10.
And how's everybody lining up? Is there a certain...
They line up at Shaw University on Wilmington Street in South.
By groups?
Anywhere you want.
Oh, anywhere you want. So it's not going to march in groups.
Right. No, you can march in groups.
Okay.
We're asking groups to bring your banners,
mm-hmm.
your flag, your sororities and fraternities, bring your Sigma, all your stuff to show who you are. We want people to identify themselves, but you can march. Nobody has set the parade outline and say, this group here, this group here.
Okay.
Just get in where you fit in, and let's march. And we march about a mile, and the actual rally starts about 11:30, and it should be over by...
Where's that going to be at, the
That's
rally?
That's going to be at the General Assembly in the mall, in the back of the General Assembly. Now, for Charlotte, we're gathering together here on J.W. Clay Boulevard, 6 o'clock that morning, in the old Walmart of the old Best Buy parking lot, which is right beside Dick's Sporting Goods.
Right.
6 o'clock, we should be pulling out about 6:30 that morning, so we can get there by 9 o'clock.
So people need to bring some coffee with them?
Bring you some coffee, eat you a good breakfast. But now we're going to have a van that's going to have food on it for people who are interested in buying food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for another cause that we're working on to help raise money for to go to Washington to fight against this immigration thing, for this immigration reform. But we're trying to make sure that everybody's prepared. We're asking people to please call, and they can call my number at 704-599-8904. And, of course, you can call Hector's number. You can call 704-957-3105. That's Democracy North Carolina, Brother Robert Dawkins. They are also a partnership.
Robert Dawkins.
Or you can call Action North Carolina, which is 704.
I don't see how far you can get.
I know his number, 526-8125. I don't think you can call that.
Well, if you
what do we call Luis?
To come with Action NC, we'll be also gathering. If you're on the east side of Charlotte, you can come ride up with us.
You got a bus, van,
we will
plane?
Have three vans going up, and I think right now we still do have a few seats available. I know that we've got probably about 2.5 of them full.
Vans. So how many do you hold in the van?
So those are 15 people vans.
Okay.
So so we'll be going up, linking up, and hopefully we'll all be able to caravan.
And Reverend, do you have vans, buses?
We have vans.
How many vans do you have?
All together, along with Action North Carolina, Democracy North Carolina, and the NAACP and the unions.
Mm-hmm.
The unions have donated the union here has donated 2 vans. So we have about 8 vans.
Oh, okay. Good. Okay. And the people can drive up also if they want.
They can drive up also.
And they can follow you guys, make a caravan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. That's what we're going to do. We're going to do a caravan. We're going to stop and pick up the people and not pick them up, but add on the people from Concord.
You're going to stop up there in Concord?
Yeah, they're going to get in the van.
Where are you going to stop up in Concord?
In Concord, we're going to stop up off of Exit 60, which is Copperfield Road, go to that Walmart, and we're going to load up some people there. But we're just going to basically add them on to the caravan.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So Concord is going. We have people going from all around the Charlotte area, different counties. And then we're going to stop again in Salisbury off Inner Street, in the parking lot off Inner Street, to feed people so they can load them.
Okay.
You know, so we got people going from everywhere. It's going to be very good. We're expecting 15,000 to 20,000 people.
Oh, man, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so now, Action North Carolina, this is not the first time at the rodeo.
No, Action NC has participated for several years. I personally was there last year. That was my first year. And it was an amazing experience, and I'm very happy to be able to participate again.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was saying, if you are on the east side, please give us a call. You can reach Action NC at 704-625-4050. Again, that number is 704-625-4050. That's our office. Leave us a message, and someone will get back to you.
Okay. Now, what's Action North Carolina their overall direction as far as what this regressive government is doing in North Carolina now as far as poverty. Is there anything that they have that you're here, tell the people about how you perceive what is going on up there in North Carolina at the assembly?
The GA. Well, Action NC, we are community. We're a grassroots community organization. We go out into neighborhoods. We talk to people on the ground, and we try to get people educated. And oftentimes, when people start to get educated, they also get irritated at the same time. It's not something that we really have to work very hard on when we start talking about how this GA, for instance, wants to cut corporate and individual taxes and put all that tax burden into your groceries. When we start telling people that, they say, "Oh, what? Really? What? Wait a minute now."
Now explain that, because some people might not know what you're talking about.
Right. So what they have proposed for the tax structure is that corporations will pay no taxes, and individuals will pay no taxes. So if you make $30,000 a year, or $15,000 a year, or $500,000 a year, you won't pay taxes on that. All right. Where your taxes will go up is on sales tax. All right? So the people who now, if you are, you know, in this state, there are very few people making $1 million or above, or $500,000 and above. There are a whole lot of people living paycheck to paycheck.
That's right.
And if you're like me, living paycheck to paycheck out here, then you know that when you start increasing sales tax, well, that affects how much gas costs, that affects how much baby formula costs, that affects how much diapers cost, and milk and cheese and bread. And
so they're going to increase taxes on
everything.
Oil and gas, milk,
right.
All this. So, but you personally won't have any state tax.
Right. And but the problem with that, Michael, is when they cut state taxes, when they cut taxes on the individual income tax, that's where they get the money to create a budget for all the states need. So if you cut out the income tax part of it, then the state won't have any money.
That's right.
So then they can easily say, well, we ain't got money to do that. They can easily get rid of education. They can easily get rid of Medicare, Medicaid.
The bottom line.
Right. And then what happens with the individual is our taxes, as high as they are, is phenomenal, because it's 7.5, 8.5 as it is. But what they plan to do is to raise the taxes from that to over 14%. So you go and you pay a dollar for something, you got to pay 14 cents, 15 cents tax. That's phenomenal. That's ridiculous.
Well, they've done that in a few of these regressive states already. I mean, they have no – they go under the banner, we don't have personal income tax. And you can look at all those states. They haven't got jack.
That's right.
They don't have anything.
In each one of those states, what you find are lower, lower
standard of living.
But lower standard of living,
yeah.
Lower education opportunities, lower hiring opportunities. And interestingly, these are the states where you find increased amounts of federal subsidies and federal aid.
And they just happen to be all the red states.
Right.
And that's the reason why Governor Christie was ranting and raving. He said, I want some of my money back.
That's right.
Because we are helping Arkansas and Georgia and Mississippi and New Orleans that don't pay nothing. And you see what happened. Now, I just want to see what happens to Georgia, what the Georgia senators and congressmen are saying now when that storm last week went through and ripped up some of that place. Let's see if they ask for, because already one of the mayors in one of the cities down in Georgia has asked for disaster relief.
And that's what they do.
Let's see if they get some disaster relief.
Yeah, but they won't vote for it. They feel like nobody needs it. And just like one of the people said in the General Assembly last week when they were voting to get rid of the maximum on the unemployment, one of the men said, well, let the counties make that decision. The counties take better care of the people. That is crazy. The counties, these poor counties in North Carolina, very few of them have any kind of money. I mean, very few. How are they going to be able to pay income tax, unemployment to anybody? It's less the money comes from the corporations in that city, and very few of them have those kind of corporations.
Absolutely.
These people are just, it's asinine. It is ridiculous.
But the whole problem is people let this get out of hand.
Yes, right.
They did not attend their local board of election meeting,
right,
their board of education meetings, their county commission meetings, their city council meetings, and all these regressive party members got in the city council, got on the school board, they went from the ground up. They didn't start at the president.
No,
they went from the ground up, and once they controlled the city and the county and the board of education, then they controlled everything in that county.
That's right.
And then they went up to the state legislature.
That's what they did. That's right.
So they started, and this didn't start in a vacuum. This started 40 years ago. 50. It started when the Civil Rights Act was passed.
Exactly.
So you know, they have been doing this for a long time.
Yes, sir.
Well, in this country, what we have is a glorification of celebrity.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
If you are, you can be a celebrity for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
All right. You can be famous for nothing.
Right.
Now, whereas before, I mean, there's always been, you know, they've always been celebrated. They've always been celebrities, and the population has always glamorized them and looked up to them. You know, you look back to the 30s and 20s
always.
And stuff. You know, they were loving people even back then. If there had been a TMZ back then, it would have been on.
Yeah, that's right.
But what's happened is people have. You know, then the politicians started to live like celebrities and started to be viewed as celebrities.
Yeah. Oh,
and what happened was we forgot, the general population forgot, these people aren't celebrities.
No.
They are public servants.
Servants.
The president is a servant. The governor is a
servant.
The mayor is a servant. All right?
Just like the policeman. Just like the policeman and
right,
the fireman.
Which means we, the people, have the right to both hire and fire them if
that's
they
right.
do not do their job.
But not only that. Not only did we forget, but the role was reversed.
Right.
Because they tell us now we do what we want. They get elected and say, well, I know what's best for you.
Right.
And we
right.
tell them what we want, but then they turn and say, well, I know what's best for you.
Well,
we know what's best. Y'all don't understand enough.
You're not talking about Larry.
We understood enough to vote for you.
You're not talking about Larry Kissel, are you?
One of them. I've heard that same statement come from a black congressman.
But either way,
that the people don't know, he knows better than the people.
Oh, of course. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
The people of North Carolina, and this is one of the things that HK on J is trying to drive home, the people of North Carolina must understand, like any employee, all right, I can't own a shop, hire somebody to run my cash register, and never talk to them for another year and expect my totals to come up right.
You think?
They know they ain't gonna see me for a year. That's preposterous.
That's absolutely correct.
So the fact that we elect people to office for 4 years, and then leave them alone, don't follow them after that. Just hey, you do what you're gonna do, and make sure you know the totals come up right. And then at the end of the 4 years, when you got less of everything, you got fewer jobs, you got less money, you got higher taxes, you got no corporate investment. You know, then we say, oh, well, let's get this other guy and let him run rampant for 4 years.
Well, one of the main things, when I first came here, and I'm from New York City, one of the first things I came here, I could not believe how the political process ran.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know in New York City, in Queens, New York, and Helen Marshall now is the borough president of Queens. I've known her when she ran for school board. We had a Democratic club besides the Democratic Party headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And at that Democratic club in East Elmhurst, every elected official, every elected official that had an office that covered that area, from the district leader, from the assembly person, from the state senator, city council member, every one of them reported to the Democratic Club in their district at least once a month.
That's good.
They came in front of everybody that the room could fill and gave their report of what they did that month.
Good.
Because, and I lived in East Elmhurst. East Elmhurst was probably larger than the whole county of Mecklenburg.
Yeah, okay.
And they reported. If they didn't show up, went out to them, what happened? But that they didn't even let that happen. They would send us worried. I won't be able to make it at this week's,
right.
this month's meeting.
Right. And that's the problem across the country. There's no accountability.
There is no accountability.
No accountability.
There is no, you know, and so no what they say, you know, and so when I brought this up, when I first came to Charlotte at the first meeting of the Democratic Party. They said, oh, what do you want to do, take over the party? I said, no. We are supposed to take, we're surrounding the party.
Yeah.
You guys work for us.
That's right.
We don't work for you.
That's right, exactly.
So you're absolutely correct. They don't understand. They now think that we work for them. We don't work for them.
That's what they say, yeah. So that's the way they reverse the role.
They the role.
Like, you need me. You vote for me. You need me. Now I'm going to tell you what you need.
Well, you see, what I found, and I just don't want to bash Charlotte, Mecklenburg County. I mean, it's the whole state. What they have gradually put people who vote in the position that, hey, don't worry about it. You get me in, I'll take care of you. You don't have to worry about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it is. And over the years, the people say, well, you know, we put him in. We don't have to worry about him. He's looking out for us.
Yeah, that's pitiful.
Yeah, hey. If you ain't looking at him every step of the way,
yeah.
It's just like saying, oh, we need to get, we're glad the Progressive Party, the Republican Party is going down the tubes. No, we should not be,
mm-hmm.
because the Democratic Party ain't just, you know, Robin Hood. If they see that there's nobody there to give them some feedback or some fight back, they will go the same way as them.
That's right.
So we need a strong Republican Party that can keep the Democratic Party on its toes.
That's right.
And if we don't do that...
But we need a strong community.
Well, yeah, well, that. But you see, when you have both of them giving good points,
right.
the community will be a lot more involved because they'll see both sides, and then they'll be more inclined to be involved.
Right.
But when you have one side that's giving
dominant... Yeah.
Forget it.
Right.
Don't happen.
You don't see the contradiction.
There's no contradiction.
Well, we need, you know, we need the strong, you know, parties. We need strong community. But and this is a totally different show. But you know, it's coming to the point where we need a strong third party.
Mm-hmm. We do.
You know, we need a strong third voice in there. Something that can, and something that isn't controlled wholly by, you know, not like the Tea Party or the Blue Dogs or, you know, something that isn't controlled by the parties themselves, something that can, because when you have two, when you only have two, they can easily
negotiate.
They can easily come to
loggerheads. But we're supposed to
negotiate. When you have a third party there that can come in and say, I'm going to break that tie, you know, we're going to do this for
But, you know, the we're supposed to have that. That's supposed to be the media. That's their job, to show what everybody is not doing. But you see, the media is now, it's been so compromised. It's been compromised because now they're no longer independent.
Right.
They're controlled by corporations.
80% of all media in this country is owned by corporations.
So, and that's the problem.
Happened, right.
Yeah,
where are we? So we don't... We're right.
Yeah. So, but what I want to do is, I want to make sure that we can tie up all the loose ends here. Luis, tell us what your goal is for Action North Carolina involved in the HKNJ Saturday and how you see that we can move this forward.
Okay. Action NC's goal is to take three vans full of people, it's roughly about 45 people, up to Raleigh, to participate in HKNJ. We want to get them up there safely. We want everybody to have a good time. We want everybody to network, to meet one another, shake hands, exchange some contact information, get to know one another, get to know the people who are working in the state for the good of the people. And we want to get everybody home safely. And
what time were you looking at coming back?
I think that we're going to try and be back sometime around 5 or 6 o'clock that evening.
Be back in Charlotte?
Be back in Charlotte.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Be
okay.
Back. People will be back to their cars by 5 or 6.
And minutes. People will be able to get something to eat while they're up there, because
yes.
I understand
yes.
Reverend Teddy
yes.
has a.
We will be stopping off to
okay.
get something to eat. There will also be one of the Action and C vans will have food for sale to help promote this trip
mm-hmm.
that many of our constituents will be taking to Washington, D.C. to make their voices heard there. So there will be some grassroots stuff, some good home cooking that will be going out there.
Mm-hmm.
If you like home-cooked Mexican food, then it's going to be really good.
I like that.
Yeah. So,
well, I wish I could go. I got to be out of town. But so, Reverend, what is the NAACP here in Charlotte? What's their outlook or what they see that this event will eventually lead to?
This is a very important and a very essential event. We want everybody in Charlotte that can go to go. We're asking churches and pastors to please talk to their congregations and members. If they will, they can lend a bus. They can send one of their own vans. You know, we would love for them to come with us and send their members. And if not, if they would please, you know, give us some support with the vans in terms of purchasing the vans, making sure there's gas and food on the vans. But then more than that, we want to reach out to all of our sororities, fraternities, social organizations, clubs, and everybody else to encourage them to come and go with us. And then right now we're anticipating and looking for at least 250 as a minimum people to go with us. We have a total of about 10 buses at this point that are supposed to go. We're looking for 16,
mm-hmm.
trying to get 16 buses to go. And we've been having people call in, so we are filling up the buses, but we want people to call in. Please call in, 704-599-8904. Call in 704-957-3105. I'll call in
704-625-4050. That's actually if you're on the east side.
And our intent is to get as many people up there as we can. This is so critical. This is a very critical era, not just a day. This is a very critical era in the history of North Carolina and the history of our state. We got to make sure that people step up, stand up first. Step up and take part and address the issues that concern us.
Did you expect any elected officials?
Hadn't heard any, but some of them in the past have gone with us. We've
yeah.
had elected officials to go with us in the past.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend, the only problem about elected officials this weekend is that I do understand that the city council have their retreat this weekend.
Oh, okay.
So, but before we've had legislatures and other city officials to ride up with them.
Well, what about people from the Assembly?
Oh, people from the Assembly, yes. Yeah, some of them are on the program. We do have some of our members of the General Assembly do come and speak because, of course, they don't agree with all the issues that the General Assembly
right.
is espousing. So some of them do come and they speak as well.
And so you're saying that there'll be some from the other party then?
If they wish, yeah.
But
yeah.
if they were, have you heard from any of the from the other party?
No, the only thing we've heard is criticism. We haven't heard any support.
And have you heard that the governor's got his box made out so he can live out in the street for about a month?
I do hope very soon this week that Pat McCrory and all of his aides from Duke Energy that he hired as his staff, I hope they would all get in a box and come down somewhere.
Well, it has to be four bedroom boxes. By the way, before we leave, do you know any place that you can get an apartment for? Did you make it in the apartment? Yeah. Dick. I'm interviewing the Reverend Hills tomorrow. So it would be great if you could come on. And I want to thank Reverend Kojo Nantumbi. I was closer. I'm getting more like Al Sharpton with this pronunciation every day. And Luis Rodriguez from Mexico, from the Action, North Carolina. And this has been The Last Word, and we'll see you.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And the president still don't understand. We're celebrating the death of the establishment GOP right along with them. Yeah, I got a cake and hats and like party streamers and everything today because they're dead. The GOP hasn't stuck to its guns or its policies or its principles in I don't know how long. All they are is about winning. Who should be in the tent? We need a bigger tent. That's the wrong angle. While the elephant may be dying. And it's not dying, it's dead. What isn't dying in America is personal responsibility.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things, but we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody, anything.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was our tie-up to the three-parter we had on with the NAACP president, Charlotte Branch president, Reverend Kojo Nantumbi. I gotta ask him again because we're gonna have a tie up when I get back in town. We're gonna do a tie up over how everything went up there in Charlotte. And inevitable Eric Rodriguez from Action North Carolina, who are gonna be up there for HK on J this Friday. Well, it starts Friday night, but really Saturday, HK on J. This is seven. This is HK on J7, which is the seventh year, and February the 9th, starting out at Shaw University and going all the way over to the assembly. They're going to march. And we're going to hear what these people have to say. Those people up there in the assembly. But right now, before we get, I got a few more minutes. I just want to talk about the GOP governors that want to take health care with Obama. They want it. There's 11 of them now. Remember all these guys say, oh, no, we don't want any part. We do not want any part of that Obamacare. No, 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 we're not going to do it. No, 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 we're not going to do it. No, 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 we're not going to do it. 11 Republican governors now, including Florida's Rick Scott, Louisiana's Bobby Jindal, Arizona Jim Brewer, even that Berdinsky in Ohio used to be in the Congress. He wants it now.
But you got this Pat McCrory, who's saying, no, 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 I don't want it here in North Carolina. Of course not. You know, of course not. He's going to take it. He's lying through his teeth. Only those morons that listen to Fox News are the ones that are believing it. They want to meet, all these 11 governors want to meet with President Obama to discuss the federal health care overhaul, including ways to make expanding Medicare and setting up online health exchanges more affordable for states with tight budgets. They sent a letter after the Obama administration said on Monday that states can do a partial Medicare expansion, but they won't get the 3 years of 100% federal funding provided under the law. See, if you do 100%, if you do 3 years, you get 100% paid for. It's paid for. States don't have to contribute one dime. Now, why wouldn't a governor want to give health care to its people free and not cost them a dime? You know why? Because when people see how good it works, they'll tell the states, you better cough up the money. We want this. That's why. Rip Scott, that moron in Florida, he previously requested to meet with the Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius to discuss his concerns that the law could bring burden to state taxpayers. Well, how, moron? They didn't say that you have to keep it after 3 years. You can take the money and run after 3 years. Scott had been a vocal critic of the Affordable Care Act, but softened his position after the election, saying he's open to working with the federal health care officials to find a solution. But he repeatedly expressed concerns about the potential costs to Florida taxpayers. Now he's one of the several Republican governors who recently sent a letter asking for more flexibility in health care laws so that states can tailor their programs to the individual needs. Sonny Lever, along with Scott, were governors from Iowa, Utah, Maine, Virginia, Ohio, South Dakota, Wyoming, Arizona, Louisiana, and good old Mississippi. The governors made several suggestions that included asking the states to be allowed to determine that their own Medicare eligibility levels and still receive all the federal funds. They also raised the possibility of imposing reasonable and enforceable cost-sharing requirements and worried that the process for determining newly eligible Medicare beneficiaries could become an overly difficult audit procedure. And Rick Scott knows about audits since he built the Medicare and Medicaid, I should say, Medicaid, out of probably over $1 billion, which would potentially jeopardize billions of dollars in payments to the states. Now, if you do it correctly, you're not going to be jeopardized. The governors also said that they want to be able to leverage their private health insurance markets to reduce dependency on entitlement programs. Because they're all in bed with the insurance company. The president and his team have met with the state leaders for more than 2.5 years, and Eric Shield Britt, a spokeswoman for the Department of Health and Human Services, said the president has welcomed an open dialogue with the nation's governors one-on-one and as a group, and Secretary Sebelius has offered to meet with Governor Scott. He should go down there with the U.S. Marshals and put that fool in handcuffs. Now, Florida has defaulted into letting the federal government run the health care exchange because lawmakers chose not to run their own exchange. Gee, I wonder why, after vehemently said, I don't want it, we don't want it. Oh, you mean, let's let the government do it. Well, they were going to do it anyway if they were going to let them in. An online marketplace where residents and small businesses can shop for health care coverage, which is the health care exchange. They could change their minds later and pursue a partnership with the feds, but that would take approval by the legislature and the governor. But it still must decide whether they will expand Medicare rolls. Officials estimate close to 900,000 residents could be covered under expanded Medicare rolls by fiscal year 2020 to 2021, costing the state $330 million. I wonder how much it costs the state now and taxpayers now. Well, you see, it doesn't cost the state anything because when you go into a daggone hospital and you have no insurance, where do you think that cost is put? It's put on us. It ain't put on the state. It's put on every person that lives in the state of Florida. That's where it's put. A Senate committee charged with overseeing the implementation of the health care law had its first meeting just last week and seemed far from making any decisions. Senator Joe Negron reminded the committee that the state will spend about $21 billion on Medicaid this year. Medicaid covers nearly 3 million people. About half are children. Lawmakers say it must be overhauled because it's eating up about 30% of the state's budget. If Florida lawmakers decide to fully expand their Medicaid rolls, the Obama administration is offering to absorb the cost for the first 3 years and pick up 90% of the tab thereafter. Florida has one of the highest rates of uninsured rates and some of the most stringent eligibility requirements in the country for Medicaid. A family of three with income of $11,000 a year makes too much, and single residents are not covered at all. Can you imagine if you make less than $1,000 a month? You're covered. If you make more than $1,000 a month, and you are part of a family of three, that means a husband, a wife, and a child, or a husband and two children, or a wife and two children, and make over $1,000 a month, you're not covered. And if you're a single person, you're not covered at all. Give me a freaking break. Rick Scott needs to be put in daggone handcuffs, and every one of those damn legislature, regressive party legislators down in Florida need to be put in handcuffs because they are criminal. They're absolutely criminal. And I get sick to my stomach every time I hear the nonsense. Okay, guys, it's the end. This has been the last word. I'm off to Charleston. Have a good weekend. Thank you.